This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, cliches are cliche for a reason. Why tropes aren't bad, but some tropes need to die.
I really do like that title, because especially when you read it out loud, because it's like, why some tropes aren't bad, but others really need to die. I just can imagine your expression.
It's the fervence, isn't it? It's like, no, they need to die now.
They need to die now.
For bloody and painful death.
It's like I look up and you're literally, you've just got a sword in hand. Like, they need to die.
That is totally how I record podcasts. I put my armour on, I get my weaponry out, and I sit down in front of the microphone.
I mean, that's what I do, so, you know.
Oh, yeah. How does anyone else do it?
Exactly. I mean, we are dissecting dragons.
Oh, that was so bad.
I know. Hence my guffaw. Anyway,
anyway, looking at tropes, I've seen people in reviews say, oh god, that was such a trope, etc. And it's always seemed a really nonsensical comment, because whatever attracted them to that book, it would have been a set of tropes, whether they realised it or not. So, for example, if we're talking epic fantasy, the chosen one, the boy with the sword, ordinary person hand destiny, dragons. People, you say fantasy and people think, oh, has it got dragons in it?
Yeah.
And, you know, those sort of things are the things that pull you in. There's nothing wrong with tropes. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with giving your readers more of what they want. Where it's a problem is when people play trope bingo and don't actually use the tropes to fully explore anything. So all you've got is a series of interlinked circumstances that clearly are aimed with an idea of selling books, but not necessarily providing a satisfactory read.
Yeah.
I mean, those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive concepts either. It's perfectly okay to make money out of writing, but, you know, do it by giving readers a satisfactory reading experience, is what I would say.
Yeah. But then, you know, it's exactly as you say, it's about how those tropes are used. So you don't need to be writing literary fiction, you know. Writing a beach sit-down kind of novel where it's just a very easy romance. The reason why we're attracted to books like that, which are incredibly easy to read, is because they make use of those familiar tropes. For instance, romance often makes use of that trope where it's, you know, girl goes after a particular guy, but other guy who she didn't really notice until now, who she kind of thinks is annoying, is the one she ends up falling deeply in love with.
Yeah.
You know, we get that in Bridget Jones, we get that in other things as well. The reason why we enjoy those, and the reason actually is part of why they're commercial fiction, they're easy to read, is because we recognise these tropes. They're very familiar to us. We're very comfortable with them. You know, in the same way that one will find reading fan fiction easier than perhaps starting a new book, is because there's a level of familiarity, which means that you don't need to necessarily invest the same kind of concentration and the same sort of, you don't need to sort of begin again, if that makes sense. And so books which use particular tropes and are attractive to us because there's this level of familiarity which makes us feel less like we're going in blind and gives us a sense of belonging, which obviously makes a book more attractive. Now, I should add that this doesn't mean that books that make use of tropes like this won't then get your full attention and won't then sort of garner a large amount of interest and, you know, effort on your part to read it and enjoy it and really, really sort of, I'm completely forgetting the word that I'm trying to use. It's really awkward. But, you know, just really investing, that's it, investing in the story. It's just about that initial entry into the story, because I think starting books can sometimes be hard. I know it's hard for me. Starting a new book can be very difficult if you don't have something familiar to pull you into it.
Yeah, I've got 2 points there, one of them slightly longer than the other, but the shorter one is that... you're absolutely right. Obviously, reading is a time commitment, and it's competition now of things like computer games and, I don't know, baby yoga, things like that. There's a lot you could be doing instead. And which sounds like a nonsensical thing coming from me, since I write books and I'm absolutely mad about books. But there is, you know, you are investing time when you sit down to read a book. Mm-hmm. And the trope thing is really interesting, I think, because I read an article the other day by Shannon Maguire, who has written like squillions of books. She's amazingly prolific and she's very articulate, very intelligent. I lightly stalk her on Twitter because, you know, she's too much of a rock star for me to actually talk to. But what she has to say is really good. And one thing that she said that was particularly interesting in this article, it was about fan fiction and why we shouldn't diss it. And it sort of encapsulated a lot of things that we'd been saying over various episodes over the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. And basically, in fiction, you have your designated main character default. Your main character default is white, male, cisgendered, Christian but not too Christian, and, you know, generally, is unless you're reading grimdark fiction, is the good guy. You don't get that many anti-heroes. And that's fine for people who identify with the default. But on the other hand, you've got all those other people who do not fall within the parameters of the default. So all types of media, film, television, video games as well, actually, push this default in your face a lot of the time. And what we seek when we read a book or when we engage with speculative fiction in any media form is it's actually to find ourselves. We want ourselves, but something a little bit different, you know, a slightly cooler life or slightly better abilities. Or we are actually looking for ourselves when we invest that fully in something speculative. Now, if you are not the default, if you do not fall into that default setting, then you spend an awful lot of time desperately trying to find yourself, but to no avail. And obviously things are changing now. We've got gay protagonists, we have trans protagonists, we have female protagonists. Believe it or not, that is still quite an issue, as we've mentioned before. But yeah, it is this idea of desperately trying to find yourself. So I remember, obviously I remember everything I've read, apparently. Not quite true. But I do remember as a child of about 9 or 10, I was reading books which had almost exclusively male protagonists because what I wanted to read was fantasy and science fiction. Mm-hmm. And the female characters always got to be the sidekicks, if they were there at all.
Yeah.
They were always the ones who waited at home and made home pleasant for the hero to come back to. It was very traditionally gender-rolled. And so I identified with the male characters. But you have to do quite a mental twist to do that if you don't naturally identify as, say, white, male, cisgendered, etc. Or in this case, you know, a mouse or a fox or whatever, because they were animals as well. I think that's probably what made it easier, actually, was the fact that they were animals rather than humans. So I was already doing that mental leap to identify with the default MC in those settings.
Yeah.
So, yeah, having tropes and knowing that when you go into it, you are going to get a certain number of sword fights. You are going to get plotting and scheming. You are going to get dragons or other fantastical creatures is comforting enough to make you want to invest in the story and identify with whatever default you've got as an MC.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're entirely right. And I think that actually the reason that it's taken so long to kind of move into an era where we're starting to see more diversity in our main characters is because we've become so familiar with identifying as this default main character. And and you know that for a long time, actually, that default main character was the same, really. Different clothes, different hair, maybe slightly different, you know, backstory. But it was the same character.
Yeah, the main blueprint, your original cutout before you put clothes and things on the paper doll, was, as you say, this set of qualities. And actually, it's done no favours to those people who do identify as white, male, cisgendered, etc., etc., because now we've got changes in media and the way we're consuming it, they're having to do the same reverse mental leap that we've all been having to do for quite some time.
Exactly. And it's literally because they're not used to it. They haven't been trained in the same way that everybody else has. And so they literally don't understand because if you've had something a particular way your entire life, you know, and not just entire life, but pretty much throughout history, it's going to kind of jar a little bit.
Well, I think that's the thing, because I actually feel a little bit sorry in some respects, because you have people who then go, well, okay, yeah, I like Jessica Jones, but now we've got this female main character, this female main character, blah, blah, blah. Why are we doing all of this? You know, it's already been, there's representation out there. Why can't we just have a straightforward story like they used to do? And they're getting absolutely pilloried for it, and they shouldn't necessarily. Somebody should actually be saying to them, okay, can we just take a moment to look at what everybody else has been having to identify with as the default all this time? And you'd find most of them would go, oh my God, I never realised. Because you wouldn't. You just wouldn't. If you fall into the default, you would not realise that everybody else's life experience is outside the default.
Yeah, you wouldn't. So that is a trope that kind of does need to die in some ways. But I mean, at the same time, I think it's important to remember that it's okay to have a protagonist who is a cisgendered, straight, white male. That is okay.
Yeah.
That's all right. But, you know, you need to understand kind of what you're doing in that sense, the trope that you are sort of falling into. And again, it really isn't a problem, because it's an established thing, and there's lots of books doing it, and you're not really doing anything wrong by doing that. In fact, you're probably doing something that's relatively safe, and you might very well be doing something. The reason you came up with this character is because of the experience that you have had writing. And I've said this before, but until quite recently, I really struggled to write main female characters. Really did. All of, you know, within the Sons of Thestian, it's still quite male orientated. I've got a few sort of good female characters, I like to think, you know, with Faye and with Luca and Beatrice and other, you know, female characters like that. But it is still incredibly male orientated. And that is because of my experience of reading when I was growing up. And the fantasy that I was exposed to. Very similarly, you know, the two YAs that I'm writing, male protagonists. And it's actually only only quite recently, you know, that I've got the Kestrel saga, obviously, and Kestrel is the main character, but she is surrounded by men, to be honest, until the second book. And then I've obviously also got my main character, Anise, in my children's book, but again, surrounded by men. In fact, there aren't any other female characters until the second book, and I am totally conscious of why I've done that and why it's happened. And it's because even now to this day, I have been so trained by my reading experience and so trained by the media around me that I genuinely struggle to write female characters, because the association in my head of what female characters should be in fiction is very, very boring. And that's not fair, because as a woman myself, it's not fair, because I certainly don't think of women that way in real life. So why is it that I do it in fiction? And it is because of that. And it's part of why this trope needs to be addressed. And it's part of why I struggle and push myself into writing female characters, because I need to actually be kinder to myself as a member of the female gender, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, taking the Unveiled series, for example, I don't really present a healthy female friendship until the last book.
This is true, you don't.
Because I think I present quite a realistic, toxic female friendship earlier in the series. And obviously I do, I personally think I do a very good sister-sibling interaction in all genders. But a healthy female friendship doesn't come along until M's at university. And I think that probably really says something about my own experiences growing up.
Yep.
So that's something I hope to redress in future books.
Yeah.
Because female friendships were very tricky for me. And that wasn't necessarily because I was doing anything wrong or they were doing anything wrong. It was just that we were all told we were doing something that did not fit with the default of what women should be doing.
Yeah. Now, that's actually something that I do feel needs to be addressed, of one of the those tropes that I really, really don't like, and that I sort of am going to play to against my better judgment. And that is the trope of a group of boys, and there's one girl, and then another girl gets introduced, and the girls don't like each other.
Yeah, on the other hand, the reverse of that is you put two girls in a group, and this happens in real life, with just men, and everybody pushes them together and says, you two should be friends, you have so much in common kind of thing, just because you both have a set of female genitalia.
Yeah, exactly.
And but it might just be that you're just a bit indifferent to each other. You have nothing in common, you're perfectly courteous.
Yeah, but it's when you have that, and I've got a few examples of books which have sort of totally done that, not done that, and have actually sort of just said, and the female characters just get along, and that makes me insanely happy. But it's like, for instance, Stranger Things.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
I think it's an excellent example of that case, and it stems from this place of jealousy, obviously, from Eleven.
Yeah,
but that was a creative decision.
It was. The thing was, I could kind of see it in that circumstance because Elle hadn't had any other friends, and then suddenly there was this other girl there.
Yeah.
And she was really awkward interacting with the boys to start with. So yes. I think that's a case of her not being properly socialised. But yeah, you're right. It's something that perhaps they could have just not continued.
Yeah, they could have resolved it, you know, at the end where Max tries to sort of introduce herself, and this is after Eleven has met her sister and sort of had a little bit more time to socialize and seen very clearly that Max is not after Mike. They could have ended it there, but they didn't, and that kind of really upsets me, because I was just there like, why do women always need to be in competition with each other? Okay, why does it have to be that way? It just kind of makes me feel really sad. But that's the way it is portrayed, that if you're one of the boys as a girl character, you're not going to like other girls. And yeah, that really...
that was definitely something I had growing up as well. It was nearly all my friends were male. I literally got to... I mean, I had the odd female friend who I got on really well with, not really at school, but certainly... when I got to university, definitely. That's so sad, isn't it? I got to about 17, 18 before I had a really, really close female friend. But I haven't had a proper group of female friends who just accept me until my 30s. Which, okay, maybe that is partly me. Maybe I'm not looking in the right places. Or maybe I just didn't have my eyes open to it. But yeah, that's all part of the you're supposed to be in competition with each other thing, or if you have only male friends and you're a bit of a tomboy, then secretly you really want to be male, which is not the case at all. It's just a case of you reject traditional female gender roles.
Yeah.
Or some of them. You may not even reject all of them. It might just be a case of I would rather play football than play with Barbies, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So... So yeah, that's a trope that I feel really needs to kind of be addressed and looked at and sort of say, why are we giving this message? You know, because at the end of the day, you know, you say, oh, but that's what, you know, some girls are like. And I agree. It is true. You know, I definitely went through that phase of saying, well, I'm not like the other girls. And it took me a long time to realise, like, hold on a second, what's wrong with the other girls?
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with not being like them. Like, I can still admire someone who really likes to paint their nails and you know, spends time on their hair. You know, I've got very, very good friends who do that. And I just think that's great. It's not something that I do, but why does that matter? It doesn't matter at all. I still love them to bits, you know. So... But it took a long time to do that, and it was literally because we are so affected by what we consume around us and by the kind of the message that's given to us, which says this is never going to work, so why bother trying? And that's just, when we continue to use that stereotype, unless we then, sorry, not a stereotype, when we continue to use that trope, unless it's then kind of actually addressed that says, actually, why were we worrying about this? We're actually really good friends. You are just perpetuating that message, which is actually quite damaging for the social interactions and self-learning of young girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually absolutely. Young boys as well, you know, young everyone, old everyone, just everyone, okay? It's just not good.
No, it's not. Okay, other tropes that, if we do some of the more positive ones first, and then we can do the ones that absolutely need to die a death in okay. fire.
Yes, in fire and scorpions.
In fire. Okay, well, there's the reluctant hero. I think most people, particularly if they read fantasy and science fiction, like the reluctant hero. If it's at all a satisfying arc.
Yes. We do like the reluctant hero. We also like the reluctant hero or not so much the anti-hero, but the hero who kind of, as you say, is the reluctant hero, who becomes a hero whilst trying to do something else and just sort of has to go along with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's Howl in Howl's Moving Castle, isn't it? He has to tell himself constantly that he's not going to do the thing he's actually really going to do to save the day in order to get anywhere near doing it. He's not just reluctant, he's absolutely adamant. You
know? But again, you know, I am going to bring this up for a while because I've just finished reading the third book. So, but the Locke Lamora series, where Locke inadvertently keeps saving people. Sorry for spoilers, but in the second book, they start a revolution and things like that. And he doesn't really get anything out of it. In fact, he keeps losing. He keeps somehow sort of saving everybody else. They topple a dictator, for instance, and they things like that. And that is absolutely not what Locke set out to do. Locke set out to make money. To steal from very rich people, and instead he keeps doing these things which are causing a sort of a world of trouble for him, but are actually kind of, yeah, are sort of having very groundbreaking results for everybody else. So he's really changing the sort of the picture whilst just very quietly just trying to sort of commit a couple of cons and instead, you know, so it's quite interesting in that respect, but I do like, we just love characters like that, characters who sort of go, oh no, I've got to do it. There's a great bit in the first Locke Lamora book where Locke has a chance of revenge, or he has a chance to go and save about sort of 500 people who were all about to sort of suffer a fate worse than death, and Locke's just like, damn it, and this isn't a choice, and he obviously goes off to save the whole bunch of people who also want to arrest him, so it's, you know, it's not fun for anyone. But I just really like the fact that he's just there like, oh, I really want revenge, but this really isn't a choice. I can't just stand by and not save 500 people. I have to do it. I just really, really like that, and I like the way that sort of things work out. And I think the reason we kind of like characters like that is because they appeal to our own reluctance in life. And the fact, you know, we go to sort of fantasy in particular and sci-fi and things like that because we want to sort of escape the mundane world and move into these magical circles and go on adventures. But at the same time, you know, there's an element of, we could be having adventures right now in our real lives. Okay, they might not involve magic, but we could be, you know, doing all sorts of crazy things and doing half of the stuff that these other characters are doing. Really, if we wanted to, there's the potential for us to be doing that. But we're not, because of, you know, reluctance, things like, okay, I don't really have the money to afford this. I really need to be doing my job. And actually, I'm quite tired, so I don't really want to go into the jungle. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
And so actually having a reluctant hero who's got the same kind of like, I just want to be making some money. I don't really want to be going and riding a dragon into a war that's nothing to do with me. I think it appeals to us because we're like, yeah, we understand
this. We're right behind you.
And yet somehow they still get the adventure. And I think that we like that.
Yeah, like the reluctant hero, but subtly different. Ordinary person handed a destiny.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
mean, not quite the whole chosen one thing. That's almost a slightly different subtrope again, but the idea that you're there minding your own business and it turns out that oh, I don't know, a magic ring falls into your possession.
Yeah.
And suddenly you were actually very happy in your previous life, and suddenly you've got to do all these things. The world has changed around you, and you have to change with it.
Yeah.
And I think people like that because secretly, yes, they want to be people reading. I mean, secretly like that because they want to be the hero, but they kind of want destiny thrust upon them, and it's the idea that anyone ordinary could do anything extraordinary.
Yeah, if given the opportunity.
Yeah.
I think it does appeal. And you mentioned earlier sort of finding ourselves in fiction.
Yeah.
Another way that we sort of find ourselves in fiction is through the world itself, and it's why side characters are really important, and the background of a world is very important. And it's, I hate to always draw back on it, but Harry Potter or Avatar or things like that. The worlds were so big, so diverse, that it meant that even if you weren't, you didn't identify as Harry, Ron, or even Hermione, who kind of evened each other out so that you could identify with something in one of them, at
Yeah.
least. You could say, but I could still go to Hogwarts. There's still a place for me there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe I wouldn't have been on the front line against Voldemort, but I would have been helping out in the herbology greenhouses or something, you know?
Exactly. So, the size of the world, it's about making you feel like it's possible for you to be there. There is a space and a place for you in this world, even if it's not with the main trio. You can belong here. It would welcome you with open arms,
Yeah.
and that the someone finds the magic ring and ends up going on an adventure. Again, it really appeals because it's that ultimate version of there is a place for you.
Yeah.
Because there is a place for anyone. It's just about chance or destiny. And I really, really like that. And I think that it really appeals to people because of that. Because it's welcoming and
Yeah.
dangerous, but welcoming.
No, absolutely. Okay, well, while we're on the subject of finding your place, one of my personal favorite tropes, in fact, one of my favorite tropes, I'm just not going to say because it's too embarrassing, but one of my personal favorites is the Band of Misfits slash Found Family,
Oh yes.
which
Oh.
I just love so much, and it took me a really long time to work out why this appealed to me, which is odd because it's really obvious, but apparently I can be really, really dense about certain things, and they only come back to me sort of when I was rereading Tamora Pierce's Circle of Magic quartet, and I don't know how many times I've reread that. They're short books. They're really more sort of children than young adult. The later books go more young adult, but I genuinely can't remember. I must have read them well over a dozen times each, and I keep coming back to them, and I'm always as enthralled the next time I read them, which is so rare because I've got a near photographic memory, so it's not like they're going to surprise me with anything.
Surprise.
And what I finally worked out it was a case of you have these four people who have had pretty miserable lives up until that point. And yet somehow they find each other and form their own family group, and it's about choosing your family. And they are misfits. They don't fit in with their own classes, with their own people. They're the most unlikely group of friends and foster siblings you can imagine. And I think it's just a case of if you acutely felt that you didn't really fit in anywhere when you were growing up, not so that you had major angst about it or anything, but just so that there was always this subtle refrain of you're wrong going on in the background. That sort of thing would really appeal to you, so, which is clearly what appealed to me, and it's clearly why I loved Six of Crows so much.
I agree. And I'm such a I'm just gonna say it, I'm such a slut for this track.
No, I'm trash for this. I really am.
Absolute trash. I really, really do like it, and I think it appeals because we've all been through that experience of feeling awkward. I mean, everyone's gone through adolescence. Well, not everyone.
Well,
I don't know how many people are listening.
Still incubating, aren't they?
Just, yeah, yeah. If you're incubating and you're listening to this episode, we recommend that you don't. Also, we're very curious about how that's happening. But anyway,
yes.
So, but you know, people who go through adolescence are always going to have that, oh God, I'm so different. Where do I belong? And when you find your clan of people, you know, it's like when you join a club and you go, I found my people. That's a great line in Gravity Falls where Mabel meets two girls who were also a little bit odd like her, and she goes, I have found my people. And I really, really like that because I totally get that. It's like the way I feel about you, Jules,
is
it's very much, I found my family outside of my family. These are my people. And I'm very protective of my little group of writer friends, if that makes sense.
No, I totally
circle.
Get that.
And it's a very, very precious feeling. And the relationships which are formed in that way are very, very, strong. And I think that particularly the reason you see it in YA is because that's the time when young adults are trying to find their own clan, and it's something that they're desperate for, and they're desperate for those kinds of friendships, those loyalties which are so unbelievably strong. We really want that for ourselves. We want to have that connection with other people. So Six of Crows is an excellent example, actually, because the reason I think Six of Crows really works is because the characters are not just different in sort of social class and sort of upbringing and things like that. They're different on so many levels. They're from different worlds, really.
You know?
They have different abilities. There's different sexualities. There's different races. There's different cultures. And actually, I think the reason why Six of Crows is also successful is that it disbands a little bit of the trope by saying that, yeah, my God, they are really strong as a unit, but they don't necessarily all trust each other at times.
No,
really.
There are tensions and friendships that form within that particular group. I mean, Nina and Inej, for example. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that they're friends, and it's just such a casual thing. And they turn out to be quite close friends.
Yeah.
But then you've got undercurrents between Matthias and Nina initially, which change, and then Matthias and I can't remember which of the other male characters it was. But generally, because of his outlook on life, he finds this character to be a bit of a lush, really. And you know,
Jasper.
It might well be. Yeah, it is Jasper, I think. Yeah.
And Matthias obviously doesn't like Kaz. But kind of does sort of recognize him as the leader, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then obviously you've got Jasper's relationship with Kaz, which is strained because of certain things. But Jasper's also kind of got a crush on Kaz, which he gets over, really.
Yeah.
But they're good friends, and you can tell Jasper is kind of a secondhand man after Inej, and Kaz and Inej have obviously got their very special relationship between the two of them, and then Jasper and Wylan, and you know, there's this web of individuality and individual friendships within the friendship group, which is actually very real. And that's particularly why I like Six of Crows, because there's a reality to it, which is that within a friendship group you are going to have different relationships between the individuals. Even if as a group they are all loyal to one another, there's going to be different circumstances and there's different history, and they've all come into it at different times. And I really, really like that about Six of Crows. And it actually reminds me of, I've mentioned it before, this other series that I've been watching called The Seven Deadly Sins.
Yeah.
And it's about this group who are called the Sins, who have come together, and they each have different history with one another, and they're all a little bit suspicious of each other. But you know, within that group you've got two who are in love with each other, you've got two who are best friends, and you've got one who they all kind of think is a bit of a freak, but my God, he's still part of the group. And they're kind of all suspicious of each other at different times because there's a lot of secrets. But again, it is that found family. It is that profound loyalty with one another, which just totally appeals. And I really like it when, having established that found family feel, you then start to look into the dynamic of the individuals within that, because it can be a little bit uncomfortable. Because sometimes you just want to say, no, everything's perfect. But it's also very realistic. Because, my God, I had friendship groups growing up. And, you know, you could say, oh, you know, we all love each other equally. But that wasn't ever true. You know that wasn't ever true. Because there was someone in that friendship group who you'd known longer. And the feelings that you had for different people were different.
And yeah.
Not necessarily less strong, but they were different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about the circle of magic, and you've got... Briar, the one boy in the group, actually thinks about this at one point, and he has like quite a special connection with Triss because Triss taught him how to read, and it's kind of his love of books and everything has come from her, and that's a really profound bond,
yeah,
in a lot of ways. And then there's Daja, and Daja's gay for a start, but she's also extremely good at fighting, and he appreciates the fact that one of his foster sisters is someone he can have a good fight with when he's feeling het up.
Yeah.
Obviously, consensually, he doesn't just jump her. And then the fact that Sandri actually will make a bit of a fuss of him and look after him, and is quite understanding and quite a level person. Yeah. So it's a case of he doesn't feel less strongly about any of them. He feels as strongly for all of them, but it's a different connection in each case.
Yeah. And I kind of want to look back at sort of where this trope came from. And you could say, you know, you look at the Arthurian legends, or you look at Finn McCool, this idea of a band of brothers who don't necessarily always get along, but my God, are they, you know, 100% behind each other. And I actually think the best example is probably the Robin Hood mythos.
Yeah, I think you might be right there.
Because it's the first time, you know, with Finn McCool and with the Arthurian legends, they were knights, you know. But Robin Hood was the first time that they were rejects within mythology that I can think of. And you can probably think of others. But Robin Hood is the very famous one. And they are. They're a group of thieves who work for the embetterment of other people. But they're rejects. And you've got these different characters who are incredibly different, you know. When, again, looking at Arthurian legends of Finn McCool, you have the different knights and things like that, you know, sort of Gawain and Gareth and Agravain. I'm just naming brothers now. Percival, Bedivere,
yeah.
Lucan, still naming brothers. They were all related. It was a huge sex fest. Anyway, sorry. But they were kind of all sort of quite similar, really. Whereas when you look at the Robin Hood mythos, you had Allan a Dale, who was this, who was a bit of a dandy, really, and was there with his lute, you know, playing songs. And then he had Much, who was called Much because his parents just said, well, he's not much.
Yeah.
He was just this tiny little boy who kind of went along with things, and you know, you had Will Scarlet and Little John, obviously. And again, I'm going to talk about Loch Lomora, because Loch Lomora really does pull from that Robin Hood mythos, in that you have Loch, who is obviously Robin Hood. He's the brains of the operation, though unlike Robin Hood, he's pretty useless at fighting, and so he relies almost entirely on his friend Jean. So that's not even like, we're not even far, Jean and Little John. Anyway, so Jean is the muscle. But Jean is also quite thoughtful and is a big, you know, he loves reading and he wears optics, so he wears glasses and things like that. And I really, really like that because you have these parallels between the Robin Hood mythos. So you've got Much and you get Bug in The Lies of Loch Lomora, and then you kind of get two sort of Allan a Dales with the Sansa twins, who can actually sing and play the harp and things like that, as is proven in sort of the second book. So you have these characters who all come from different parts and different places. You know, Jean is actually a merchant's son. Bug is from the worst part of Camorre, and never talks about it. Locke was obviously kind of sort of thrown out into the world after a huge plague in Catchfire, and that he survived. And you know, the sons of Twist, they all come from very different backgrounds, and they were all sort of brought in together. And now here they are impersonating other people, and they have this knowledge about all these different classes. And they are this found family, because they're this family of rejects that Camorre literally forgot. They were the orphans that no one cared about, that no one took care of. And instead, they created their own family.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to steer us on to another trope.
Okay.
Now, because we could pretty much do another episode on this.
Yeah, we could.
You mentioned romance earlier. Romance is weirdly one of those genres, and admittedly I don't read a lot of it, where they're very hidebound to actually hit certain tropes and to completely avoid others. So, for example, if you are writing a romance novel, you absolutely avoid having either of the main characters cheat. It's an absolute no-no.
Yes.
You will alienate your audience. But the one I like, and it does crop up a fair bit in speculative fiction, is enemies to lovers. So they start off absolutely hating each other or despising each other. Think, I don't know, Princess Leia and Han Solo, and end up sort of really hitting it off by the end because they're thrown together in danger so many times.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, you do kind of get that trope reversed in more modern renditions, but it's never about really the ultimate pairing, if that makes sense.
No.
Cheating's a hard one, really.
Well, we won't go into that because that is really very much a romance type thing, but it was just as an example to say, you know, it's weirdly hidebound as a genre. But yeah, the enemies to lovers thing really does come up in romance and speculative fiction. Obviously, we've talked about love triangles before, so I won't go into that. And there are various others. We should probably look at some of the tropes that really do need to be wheeled out or rowed out to a lake and made to look into the water while you put two in the back of its head kind of thing. The one I came up against very recently, I did a buddy read of a book called Sky in the Deep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically young adult, female MC who is a warrior. You can't see me, but I'm basically making inverted commas with my fingers around warrior.
Yep.
I didn't love the book. I can see why other people might have loved it. All that aside, the book relies on rape threat for about 60% of its tension. Well, actually, it relies on rape threat for tension and jeopardy of the main character for about 60% of the book, to the point where you're then expecting it for the rest of the book as well. And I've got a real problem with this. First of all, in the book, and it's not just this book, I don't want anyone to think I'm particularly slamming this book, it happens in YA fiction, and it just needs to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Rape threat against a female MC, it's used as shorthand. It's used as shorthand to say that the antagonist is evil without ever exploring why or how or what else is wrong with them or making them three-dimensional.
Yeah.
It's also, very few of these books that use it don't use the word rape ever, anywhere within the book. And that's really starting to piss me off, because if you're going to put it on the table, you can't then just whisk a cover over it and say that it's not there. So if you put it on the table, I think you have a duty, actually, to explore it fully, or at least not pretend that it's not anything else. You know, stop using words to minimise it.
Yeah.
And actually use the word rape. And my other problem with it is the fact that it's such a serious topic anyway.
Mm.
And it's feeding into this ongoing mythos that rape is part of the female life experience, when it doesn't have to be. It's not. We're spoon-fed this continually throughout life. And it's genuinely, it's not something that is actually really true or has to be true at all. So we need to stop seeing it in fiction. We really, yeah. really do.
By continuing to use that rape trope, what you're basically saying is that this is normal. And it's not normal. It may happen to everyone, but my God, it's not normal. And it shouldn't be allowed to be felt as normal. You know, I remember being assaulted when I was just quite young, as an adolescent, and not doing anything about it, because I just thought, yeah, well, I guess this just happens.
Yeah.
And that's not right. And it shouldn't be dismissed. And it shouldn't say, well, as you say, it's not an inherent part of life, and it shouldn't be treated as such. And if you are going to bring up rape, and this is the thing, is that, you know, people argue like, well, yeah, we should be talking about it, we can't just pretend it doesn't happen. You're absolutely right. And okay, I'm going to use my own books as an example. In Blood of the Delphi, there's actually three cases of rape which are talked about in sort of kind of subtly in some ways. The first one is that Rufus obviously is assaulted by someone in order to kind of stay hidden with the halfling. Second is that you find out Zachary was kind of groomed. Well, not kind of, he was groomed by a maid in his household and sort of forced into having sex when he wasn't really ready for it, and kind of manipulated in that way. And that was rape. And the third is that Aurora gets attacked by Sperrin. Those are three cases that have been used. And I have talked about rape in that sense. And it's something that is discussed further on in the books as well, and actually looked at. And something someone pointed out to me and said, actually, it's odd because there are three cases of rape in this book, and two of them are with the male characters.
Yeah, which actually made them noticeable. I hate to say it, because we are conditioned to expect it to be part of the female life experience. It makes us sit up more if it's happening to a bloke.
Yeah, it somehow
makes it Outlander.
Yeah, we think, oh wow, this is worse, and it's not worse. It's all terrible. Okay. Rape is terrible no matter who it's happening to. And that's not me saying that it's just one level of fucking awful. I'm sorry to swear, but there's no other way that I can say it. It's just terrible. Okay. And yet, because we are so used to seeing it happen to women, and we're so used to the effects of it happening to women and what it does to women, it's less shocking, and it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. And if you are going to do it, and it's okay to do it, it's okay to discuss women being raped, because women are raped, my God, they are. You need to then actually address that. You need to actually do that properly. It can't just be something that is just brought up, the threat of rape, okay? It can't just be in the background there. That's something that's happened. That is a trauma. And that is something that's going to stay with the character for the rest of their lives, okay? It's not something you ever just sweep under the carpet. You have to address that. If you are going to use rape or sexual violence, you need to address the consequences of that. And you also need to address why the rapist is doing what they're doing. What is the motivation? Because that's another thing, you know, we talk about, oh, he's a villain, therefore he's very rapey. Like, really? Really? It's one reason I really enjoy I really enjoyed the first Daredevil, because you had Kingpin, who was very clearly a villain, but my God, he was very respectful to women.
Yeah.
The whole way throughout.
It's not a case of... I need rape and sexual assault to stop being used as shorthand in fiction, basically. It can't be shorthand for villainy. And it can't be shorthand for, oh, this scene needs a bit more tension.
Yeah.
So that you can then abandon it later.
Yeah. Why is it happening? Why? You've got to have a reason. Even if it's just a reason that you know, why is this person committing rape. Because actually, I don't think most people are capable of it. I really don't think most. I think you need to have a certain mindset. You need that something needs to prompt you to rape someone. It's not something that just naturally happens. You don't go, well, I'm feeling quite villainous today. It doesn't happen. Even bad people don't go around raping other people all the time.
Okay? Yeah, it's not about biological imperative. It's not about sexuality. It's entirely about a power play. And I think if it's someone who requires making a play for power in whatever sense, and they can do it in other ways, they tend to. It takes, as you say, a particular mindset.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't ever give me the, oh, but the character didn't really know what they were doing. I mean, I'm not saying that wires can't get crossed and we're in murky waters there, but at the same time, for one thing, have the balls to actually call it rape. Don't minimise it by using synonymous words for it, because, you know, the word rape is too difficult.
Yeah.
Okay, so that definitely needs to go. I think the thing you can look at things like the way women are treated in fiction in generally, which we've done before, so I won't go into it. Mm-hmm. And it's the fact that we do see ourselves as women either held up as sexual objects or meek stay-at-home types, or, you know, you see ourselves raped, murdered, etc. to provide man pain in order to get the male MC moving. That's bad.
Yep.
It's a very... That's next door to the bury our gaze trope, which is something I think we should talk about.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. Yes. Gender stereotyping. The trope of gender stereotyping is very painful and needs to stop. It really, really needs to stop. We could have an entire episode about why, but the shorthand is that it's damaging. And it's just the same as always having the same kind of protagonist. You are going to be really, really narrowing what can be seen. And that gender stereotyping is the reason why I really struggle to write female characters. Because the female characters who are present adhere to a gender stereotype which wasn't even resembling anything close to myself or anyone that I actually genuinely knew.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose feeding into that, you have the assumed heteronormativity as well. That,
yes.
That's something that I don't think we can expect everybody to just dump that one overnight, but it would be good if people just started broadening themselves a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, bury your gaze.
Ah, yes. The idea that if you bring a gay character into a story or a queer character of any form, it has to be tragedy. Which is really...
Yeah, it's very much the same as the way women are used to provide man pain, and we tend to end up as girls in refrigerators, or we end up raped, murdered, tortured, etc. Or just, you know, we make a wrong choice. We are punished for it in fiction. We really are. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. It's this sense that gay people, or people who are asexual, or just do not fit, again, that default of mm-hmm. heterosexuality, are punished, really punished in fiction. So gay people are basically seeing themselves murdered over and over and over again in fiction.
Yeah. Which is so damaging on so many levels. It's unfair. Sorry, this is something that actually genuinely upsets me, so sorry.
No, that's okay. It's wrong. And most of it, unfortunately, comes from thoughtlessness. It's a case of, we bring this character in, we're not really sure how to develop their arc, we need a death to happen, perhaps we're talking Walking Dead, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to have a certain body count with the Walking Dead, because that is the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
But it didn't have to be a gay character.
It didn't. I think the other thing is that you have these gay characters, and they fall into that archetype of character. Basically, you want a character who is an innocent, if that makes sense. And in trying to say, look how progressive we are, we don't see gay people as gross, or we don't see gay people as villainous or anything like that. So we're actually going to make it the total opposite. They are pure. Their purity itself, and purity itself in these shows tends to be killed off.
Yes, because it's not a survival mechanism.
So they create this character who's gay, and to sort of show their support for homosexuality, they make this character overly pure in an unrealistic way, overly good, wholesome, things like that, and then they kill them. And it's also, you get that as well with not just kills them, but also killing them, but also the fact that their entire arc is about them finding themselves. Now, don't get me wrong, coming out stories are important. They really are important. But for every single gay character to be coming out at any time, and to be going through a phase where, for some reason, you can tell these are coming out stories written by people who have never had to come out.
About anything.
Because they're like, I don't like labels, or they just say it completely wrong. And you're like, maybe that's the experience for one or two people out there, but it's so warped. And the death toll for gay characters, particularly lesbians, particularly bisexual women and lesbians, because my God, they're gay and women.
How dare they eschew the mighty root, as it were, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even going to talk about trans people, the way they are punished in media. It's unspeakable. And you know, they really do get the worst of it, because they get raped and murdered, and it's never sort of really covered up. It's horrifying. And it is actually a conversation about the real genuine violence that is happening today. And I agree that that is not something that should be swept under the carpet. It's something that should be acknowledged. However, at the same time, you need to start putting out media. I'm saying you, it's not you, Jules, but it's just people.
I'm doing my best.
You're doing your best. People need to start putting out media which normalizes queer individuals and stops making them another, okay? The moment we start having the normalization of queer characters is the moment that younger people start to accept queer characters as the norm. And the violence, I'm not saying it'll end, but I'm saying that it will lessen, hopefully. Will become something which isn't sort of commonplace. Oh God, I remember being homophobic, which is funny for a queer person. I remember being homophobic in school simply because it wasn't something that was ever talked about positively, and it was just always used as an insult. Well, that's gay. You know what I mean? Oh, it's the worst thing in the world to be gay. And that really made coming out to both myself and to others very, very difficult. Because I saw it in such a negative connotation, because that was all I saw. And it wasn't that these kids were vicious. Well, I mean, kids are vicious, but it wasn't that, you know, that they were out there, you know, going to Nazi rallies or anything like that. They were just kids, just normal kids. And it was just a lack of media, which meant that they were never once challenged to really think about what they were saying or why they were saying it. So just putting it out there.
Absolutely. There are two points. You touched on this, but when you say, oh yeah, I'm diverse, I've included gay characters, for example, and it's like, okay, point to the gay character. What are they? Well, they're the gay character. It's like, yeah, but what's their character? You're telling me their sexuality, not the character, kind of thing. So it's no good saying, obviously, that, well, I've got gay characters, and then you don't give them a character at all. That's exploitative for a start. And
a gay character, that's just a gay.
what you're actually saying there is, it's a suggestion that literally your sexuality, if it does not hit the default, it is somehow all that you are, which is utter bollocks. What I really liked about the first season of Jessica Jones was you had that bitter, acrimonious divorce between Jerry, the lawyer, and her wife.
Yeah.
Where she had cheated on her with another woman, a younger woman, and it was horrible and bitter and, okay, yes, unfortunately, her ex-wife dies because of the whole circumstances with Kilgrave and everything. But at the same time, that I would have said definitely wasn't a bury your gaze thing. You had enough queer characters there for a start.
Yeah.
And it fit with the entire situation, which was utterly, you know, just horrific from a human point of view.
Yeah.
But it made the characters far more than just their sexuality. They weren't ticking the gay box.
No.
It was very much a case of they're gay, they're people, and you know what? People are shitty to each other. They really are.
Yeah, they are. And it was also about saying that it wasn't about falling in that trope, which is that villains are going to be gay, which is that you get that queer villains who are sort of promiscuous, because again, it's the idea of promiscuity and homosexuality are connected.
You must be sexual deviants, yeah, kind must of be, thing.
Yeah, because it wasn't about villainy in that sense. It was just bad people. But they weren't villains, they were just people.
Yeah.
And that was very, very refreshing. Okay, well, I just want to talk about one more trope, which I feel is quite important. And it's actually something that I found in particular whilst teaching the Gothic, adapting the Gothic module at the university, which is madness. I'm not saying the Gothic is madness. It is madness. I'm saying that that craziness is a trope which is often used. So people, he's like, oh, well, they're crazy. And I've definitely touched on this before, but it is something that kind of I feel quite close to my heart. So the Gothic, you have madness, which is a trope within the Gothic, which was fine for the Victorian period. Well, it wasn't fine for the Victorian period. We're not going to talk about Victorian asylums this episode. We'll have a whole episode about that. That'll be a terrifying episode.
Yeah.
But it was just, well, they are mad. And it's not really a good enough excuse to use anymore.
No.
And the way that depression, anxiety, and particularly things like schizophrenia.
Epilepsy,
yeah. Epilepsy is, we should probably talk about epilepsy, Jules.
Not a mental illness, but certain forms of it, very briefly, it can actually look a bit like schizophrenia to the untrained mm-hmm. eye.
Yeah.
And yes, they used to lock us up in asylums for it.
Yeah.
So
it's so that's fun, but yeah, it's the fact that the amount of times that I would be reading manuscripts or the work submitted, and it was just, and they were crazy, or oh, they were schizophrenic, and I just thought, why have you done this? Now, I appreciate the fact that if you go around murdering people, then there's definitely something wrong with your head, but that doesn't mean you're schizophrenic, okay? There are lots of murderers out there who are not schizophrenic. In fact, there are more schizophrenic people out there who don't go around murdering people than there are schizophrenic people who do go around murdering people.
Yeah, I have to say, it always irritates me in the news where it's very noticeable there's an attack, somebody dies, and if it is a person of colour, then they're nearly always branded terrorists. If it's yep. a white person, they're a troubled individual with a history of mental illness. I mean, these things do no one any favours.
Like, screw you, I'm a troubled individual with a history of mental illness. I haven't gone into a school and shot a bunch of preschoolers, okay? I really do think that if you are... anyone who goes around murdering does have a problem with their head. Okay, but the problem is that you cannot use labels like just really generalized labels of just saying, oh, they had this, that, or the other. And especially, you can't always draw on very particular forms of mental illness. So I'm using schizophrenia because it's the most commonly one that's used. And the schizophrenic people are horrifically abused in life.
Yeah.
Schizophrenic people are more in danger from other people than they are danger to someone who doesn't have schizophrenia. Okay, they are incredibly vulnerable people within the healthcare system and outside of the healthcare system. And whilst there is sometimes some violence there, which can't really be, you know, it's the circumstance, okay? The truth is that these are not inherently a danger. They're not inherently dangerous people. They're just ill.
No, we're back to the whole idea of using a word as shorthand, like, for example, calling someone a psycho.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, there are a lot of people who might be functionally psychopaths or sociopaths, and actually they're fine. They're contributing members of society. It's just that they're divorced from certain things, certain aspects of human personality, which we would consider normal. Note the wording, we would consider normal. Okay, forgive the use of words here, but using words like psycho and retard, even saying things, well, don't have an epi fit.
Yeah.
And it's like, what you're actually doing there is you're using somebody's disability as an insult.
Yeah. I remember, I might have said this before, a teacher when I was at school. I think I've definitely said this before, talking about disability. But a teacher who, when we were all misbehaving, suddenly totally freaked out, slammed his hands against the desk and just went, "You are behaving like a bunch of dyslexics." And I was so shocked. I didn't say anything, but I was like, "I am dyslexic. What do you mean behaving like a bunch of dyslexics? How does dyslexic people behave? You know, there are so many people, very successful people in history and in our modern day who are dyslexic. What do you mean behaving like a dyslexic?" And he had a very particular idea in his mind of how a dyslexic person should behave. And it errs on that word that I really hate, and genuinely, again, it's one that stabs me every time it's used, which is the R word, which is retard. I hate that word so much. And it airs on that. It's the dyslexic is the new retard. It's the acceptable form of saying retard, he clearly thought. And I sit here, it genuinely makes the blood drain from my face. Because that's the idea. It's, as you say, it's the using the shorthand. It's about saying, well, I've seen one person who's like that. Or I've heard of one person who's like that, or I've adhered to a stereotype and therefore have decided that everyone on a very large spectrum within that disability must be like that.
Yeah.
And it's completely not true. I mean, it's exactly like for you, Jules. You know, we say epilepsy.
Yeah.
And you have a very narrow idea of what epilepsy entails.
Well, yeah, I mean, the people generally, until you point out that there are so many different types of it, think that you're definitely going to have a tonic-clonic seizure, that you're unstable, that you can't drive a car, and,
yeah,
and various other things. And I probably shouldn't be allowed to drive, say, public goods vehicles and buses and things because of the licensing issues.
Yeah.
Not that I particularly want to, but, you know, it sucks that that's an avenue that's closed to me. But I will accept that because the reality is that I cannot 100% say that it might not happen, you know?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, to constantly have people giving you the side eye, it's like, I'm not going to have a fit. I'm fine. I've been seizure free for, you know, 14 years. It's just, it's something I have to live my life accordingly with.
Even I fell into that. When you told me you were epileptic, and I was there like, is there anything I should know? Please tell me what to do. I'm not saying you were tart with me. You were just I could just tell that you had had to answer this question many times before. And you were like, just do this and that's fine. And I was there like, I'm so sorry.
No, I actually appreciate it when people ask, because that's far better than someone giving you the lazy eye and sidling off into the sunset, which I've also experienced. And you wouldn't necessarily know, because if you haven't come across it, if there isn't someone in your family, you wouldn't necessarily know. And I will say, quite honestly, that having been on hand at 16 when one of my friends was having a seizure, having the same sort of seizure that I have, in fact, they're terrifying to watch.
Yeah.
They're really, really frightening. I can totally understand why people are a bit sort of, oh God, there's something really not right with your brain.
Yeah.
And they're right. There's something really not right with my brain.
Yeah. One more thing that I sort of want to talk about before we wrap up this whole discussion, which is also the linking between disability and stupidity.
Yes.
And once again, this is from personal experience. People think that I'm stupid when I talk about dyslexia. But it kind of really shocks people when I'm up lecturing. I've had sort of several students, you know, I say, are you dyslexic? And they get quite embarrassed about it. And I say, well, I'm dyslexic too. And they're like, but you're a lecturer. It just doesn't seem to equate the idea that I could be a writer and a lecturer and sort of have a successful job and be dyslexic.
Like there was a level of achievement you should have stopped at.
Yeah,
and nobody basically told you.
Yeah, or that I'm special because of it. And I'm like, no, there are lots of very successful dyslexic people. It's just means that your brain works differently. But from a very personal standpoint as well, my mother was an incredibly intellectual woman, very, very smart, you know, spoke multiple languages, more languages than me. And I tend to think that I speak too many languages. She was on the sort of same level as you, Jules, when it came to languages. Okay. This is,
I'm sure your mother is better than I am.
You know, she was really good with languages. She was a teacher. She would have done a PhD if she hadn't fallen in love with a strange Englishman, and decided not to go with it. But you know, this was a woman who graduated from one of the best universities in France and spoke like a native English person, despite the fact that she was completely French and could speak Corsican and Italian and just picked up languages so easily. So this is a remarkable woman with a lot, a huge, just who gobbled up books and was just really, really insanely smart. And first of all, her smartness was sort of forgotten about because she decided to become a housewife. She stopped working so that my father could move and pursue his work, and so that when my brother and I went to boarding school, whenever we came home, she could have had a job. But she said, I'm not going to take a job because it means that when my kids are here, I can spend all my time with my kids. So she sacrificed that so that she could be with us and so that she could support my dad. So first of all, her intelligence was seen as lesser because she decided to become a housewife.
Yeah.
And second of all, when she became ill with meningitis and when, you know, she became terminally ill and towards the time before she died, she was incredibly sick. So she lost her ability to speak and to see, so she became blind and her voice would slur a lot, and speaking became very difficult and hearing became difficult, and she was in and out of consciousness and times like that, and it was very difficult for her to communicate. And I was so thankful for the majority of her friends who just that didn't matter. I think it's fair sometimes when you see someone like that, it's incredibly scary and you don't want to see it. So some people stayed away, and I can resent but also understand that.
Yeah.
But it was also that every now and again there'd be new people who just wouldn't talk to her. They talked to me or whoever was who had the wheelchair because we were clearly the handler, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And they no longer saw my mother as a thinking person, but just sort of as an object. And they just thought that she's not going to understand, or you need to sort of talk down. And I would say, look, talk slowly because she's having trouble hearing, but she's not stupid. Okay. And this is the case for a lot of people who are wheelchair bound as well. It's just this thoughtlessness of seeing not a person, but an obstacle.
Yeah.
And that's perpetrated in media as well, and it really, really does need to be stopped.
It's once again anyone who, oh, I should have said able-bodied before, but you know, or but apparently able-bodied, anyone who, again, yeah, who falls outside the default.
Yeah, yeah.
So yes, those tropes need to die a fiery death.
Throw them into the pit. Well, that actually went to a more heartfelt place than I expected.
Yes,
for us to talk about tropes. So let's go on to a positive now and say there are tropes that we love and there are tropes that we'd love to see more of, and found families is definitely right there at the top for both of us.
Yeah.
Jules, I am really curious about that embarrassing trope that you don't want to talk about.
Oh God, I'm never going to live it down if I say it.
Go on, go okay. on.
Occasionally, I like to break away from speculative fiction and read something very unlikely, like, say, Georgette Heyer. Georgia Heyer writes Regency. Well, she's dead now, so she doesn't write anything. But she did write.
You know.
Well, that I know of. Yeah, to be fair, she wrote Regency romances and various other historical things. Her Regency romances were very on point. She didn't quite include the political satire that Jane Austen did, but her research was impeccable, and they're light, they're funny, and they're quite sharp. Obviously, they obey a lot of the romantic tropes, which really haven't changed much over hundreds of years. But there's one trope that I have a secret enjoyment of, and you are going to piss yourself laughing at me.
Go on, go on.
It's the marriage of convenience, when you have two characters who are really unlikely and may not even like each other that much, but quite often they're just sort of like, yeah, you're okay. And they, you know, in Georgette Heyer, it's a case of the gentleman will not gain his inheritance until he marries because his elderly aunt wants him to settle down. Mm-hmm. And the girl in question perhaps doesn't have much of a dowry, but her family's really oppressive. So they decide to get married. They have a marriage of convenience where they don't sleep together or anything. They're just kind of friends, and they agree that they can both see other people as long as they're discreet. And then they end up, through the progress of the book, getting into all sorts of scrapes together and then finally falling for each other at the end.
Oh, Jules!
I don't like romance, I will honestly say that, but I really enjoy those stories.
No, I'm actually going to be with you. That's a trope that I can get behind. I really, really do enjoy that as well. The falling in love when you're not supposed to, if that makes sense, but actually you are supposed to. I really, really do like that.
It's sort of like we get married just because we need to. That one of my favourite books is The Morning Gift by Ava Ibbotson. And in order to get 20-year-old Ruth out of Vienna, the professor, who'd been a friend of her family, can't get her a passport of her own because she's a quarter Jewish, and this is during the Second World War. So he marries her, and it's supposed to be a marriage of convenience, and then it turns out that she ends up studying at the university he lectures at, and they're supposed to stay away from each other because they're trying to get a divorce and do it all quietly so no one's families know about it. Yeah, it all goes completely pear-shaped. Sort of, they just keep getting thrown into each other's paths, and she keeps trying to set him up with people, and it's not working. And, you know, she has a boyfriend coming over from Hungary, and she realises she's not in love with him, she's in love with this professor she's married.
Yeah, I think the friends to lovers is a trope that I really enjoy, but also the fake relationships is one that I can totally get behind, where it's fake relationships that turn into real relationships. And you see it all the time in fan fiction as well, the, oh God, there's only one bed, what will we do?
It's fine. I don't snore, do you? No.
Yeah, we know exactly where this is going. And I am 100% behind it. I really do enjoy that. Friends to lovers and the fake relationships trope. So I'm 100% behind you on that, Jules, and thank you for sharing. So to our dear listeners, please tell us, what are your favourite tropes, and what are the tropes that you want to throw into the fiery pits of hell?
Yes.
Now, before we go, it's time for Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and this time Jules has got one for you. Jules?
Yep, I've just finished buddy reading The Spellbook of the Lost and Found by Moira Fowley Doyle, which is an excellent book. It's a little weird to get into to start with, because there's three points of view and they're all told in first person, and one of them's quite lyrical language. It's more magical realism than out and out fantasy, but it's witchcraft, and it's modern-day Ireland, and it's just great. It has wonderful, diverse representation in there. There's lots of queer characters, there's plenty of queer relationships, and it embraces that found family thing. These unlikely people sort of end up being thrown into each other's lives by this spell that's done in the past. And while they're trying to unravel what's happened and why all these things are going missing, and why they keep finding this other random stuff that they didn't ask for, they sort of end up forming a really strong friendship group, and it's lovely. And it also deals with some really important issues. It's a very theme-heavy book. It looks at things like sex positivity, and it looks at things like it looks at consent. It also looks at things like how the concept of virginity is actually a really outmoded sexist concept.
Yeah.
And it doesn't labour the point, but it just sort of says, here are the facts, draw your own conclusions. And it looks at the idea of sibling relationships and parent-child relationships and how in all human interactions, things can get a bit fucked up.
Yeah.
But there's still stuff there that's worth saving. And it's the idea that sometimes you have to surrender things in order to bring more good things into your life.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really great book. I highly recommend it.
Okay. Well, thank you for that recommendation, Jules. And on that note, guys, we will catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.